Welcome to the next episode of The Break Breakdown. This is Courtney. I'm your host. And today's episode, I'm so psyched about because as my guest, I had Grace Baldridge. If you don't know who Grace Baldridge is, I feel like that's only going to be for a short amount of time more. They are an amazing artist, creator, thinker, spirit. And my conversation with them was so amazing because what Grace does is kind of just cross artistic boundaries. They're a documentary filmmaker and host. They're a musician. They write their own music. I mean, like, blow your mind. Music makes me feel things that I need to, like, unpack later. Like, beautiful music. They are have their own podcast with their wife Lizzie called Under Our Roof. I mean, it's literally what does Grace not do is the question that I had to ask. And when I was getting ready for this interview, I was getting more nervous and more nervous and more nervous as I got to know their work, because I just felt like, man, just so dynamic, so realized, so utterly vulnerable and open and just next level shit. You know what I mean? And whether or not that is understood by certain forms of the mainstream or not, I think it's going to be if it's not like on the way already. But, you know, just the way that they're able to communicate and the way that they're able to express these very deep and truthful and beautiful things about being a human being. This is why we make art. So for a little background on Grace, there are a couple places where you can find their work. They go by Semler for music. That's their middle name, Grace Semler Baldridge. So if you look them up on Spotify or Apple Music, look for Semler, S-E-M-L-E-R. And then their docuseries was on Refinery 29 called State of Grace, and it's a series that explores the intersection of human rights, sexuality, and faith. And as someone who has kind of grown away from the Christian faith, but still, I still consider myself super spiritual, I mean, very much connected to God in my own way outside of organized religion, I feel like the way that Grace talks about religion and what it can do and how it can serve is some of the most compelling reasons, or maybe reasons is the wrong word, but some of the most compelling dialogue that I have heard on the strength of religion. And, you know, wherever you fall in that, it doesn't really quite matter, because what they're doing is creating an open space for you to ponder, for you to consider different things, different angles. Whether you've come from a really religious background or a completely atheistic background, like, they're like, yeah, let's all come together and figure this out. One of the things they say in this interview is, you know, that they believe we're spiritual beings having a human experience, not the other way around. And I think what was so fascinating for me in this interview is to hear how their mind works and how they think about things and chew things over, and how that then translates into all of this prolific work that they do. And if you are someone who feels like you're pulled in 18 different directions and you're interested in this and you're interested in that, and hey, what about this and what about that? I feel like this interview and what Grace has to say is so amazing because they just own it. And I don't know that we live in a culture that wants you to own your complexity and your idiosyncrasies of, you know, there's a documentary series, but then there's music, but then there's a podcast, but then there's, you know, it, people want to say like, oh, well, what do you do? What do you do? And this conversation is for you if you've ever had the thought of like, I hate answering that question. I do a bunch of things. I don't know how to label myself. This is chaos inside my brain every time someone asks me that. And I am one of those people. So talking to Grace, I mean, I was completely uplifted at the end of this conversation. Craig was in the other room and he was like, well, that sounded like fun. And I was like, it was. It was really fun. So anyway, without further ado, I am really excited for you to hear this interview with Grace Baldridge. They are an amazing human. Check out their latest EP, Preacher's Kid, that was just released just this February 2021. Check out State of Grace on Refinery 29. Follow them on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok. Apparently the TikTok is the thing. And follow them there. Get on their bandwagon because I think, man, just all good, big, beautiful things ahead. Hope you guys enjoy. Thank you so much for hopping on. I truly need to just let you know I'm so fangirling about talking to you.
Oh my gosh.
So let's just jump right into it anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Kara Griffin, one of my dear friends, was like, you have to talk with Grace Baldridge.
That's so nice. No, I'm so honored.
Oh, I mean, she was like raving and I was like, okay, well, whatever Kara tells me to do, I'm like, yes. And then I was like, all right, let me get into your work. And
and you're like, oh gosh.
No, I'm like, what doesn't she do? What doesn't she create? And on top of which, this is why I'm like truly fangirling. Like I was so nervous last week to talk to you. Cause I'm like, oh gosh, Courtney, get it together. I feel like your work is so you have like the music side of you, you have the documentarian film production side of you.
Yeah.
You have this incredible political voice. You also have like just your everyday life, I'm assuming too. Like you've got to cook the chicken and like take out the trash.
I mean, I truly do not do any of the cooking in my house. My wife handles all of that. I'm not even allowed close to the stove, but I have been known to take out the garbage in my day. Mm-hmm. I have done that.
It's an important task.
Someone's got to do it.
Someone has to do it. But your work is so, and I understand as an artist, maybe it doesn't always feel like that, but from the outside, it is so fully realized. It is so thoughtful, particular, moving. Like I found myself, let's just go into music first. I have a bunch of questions I sent you.
Yeah.
Like, let's just.
You're so kind. I'm kind of overwhelmed. You're so kind. I also just want to say, I'm just a big fan of Kara. Obviously, like she's so incredibly talented. She's another sort of multifaceted person. I couldn't believe when I heard her music for the first time, on top of the million of other things she does at such an exceptional level. So
yeah,
I was very happy to like make this connection, and you are just absolutely like humbling me. I'm very flattered, but thank you so much for the kind words.
Oh, you're welcome. And I hope you recognize it as like a reflection of the work that you've done in your art and your craft to be compelling.
I appreciate that. That's like, it means the world. Cause I think most of the time when you're creating something, I have like two moods. The first mood is like, this is the coolest thing ever. And this is the worst thing that a human has ever made. And those are I only alternate between those two.
There's nothing in between. There can't be.
There's never like this is like kind of cool. This is fine. Like I'm vibing to this. It's like, this is high art. This is like Oscar worthy. This is a Grammy. And it's like me on a USB mic. Like, oh my gosh, this is groundbreaking. This is the Beatles. And like, this will end in my divorce. How bad this song is. Yeah. Like my wife will hear this and be like, this is the worst noise that's ever been created. This is the worst expression. And I need to leave this person. And those are the only things I oscillate between.
And no matter how many times you go through the creative process, there's no moment where you're like, oh, this is part of the creative process. It is either absolute victory or absolute tragedy. I hear that very deeply. So it's interesting. So your music, I was listening to your music. I know you have music coming out. I think by the time this episode airs, it will already be out. So then at the end, we'll kind of tack on where people can find that and all that. But I actually found myself experiencing your music, like getting very overwhelmed by it. And we started this interview 7 minutes ago. So let's just go right there. Like in my therapy sessions lately, I've been realizing how much of my own expressiveness has been contained. And so listening to your music and its expression, and it's like, there are some lingering things. Like there are some lingering questions at the ends of songs and lingering questions, even in like, you know, the detail that you pull out and just let us sit with it without offering like, and now here's how I'm going to wrap it up in a bow. Right. Mm-hmm. There's this deep expressiveness to it. And I felt myself being like, I have to pause because I have to do some other work where I need to like, not be emotionally charged in like the best way, you know, yeah. I hope you hear that in the best way. And it was really so, so like thrilling because I know you also have State of Grace, your docuseries that is like this huge hit. And I guess circling back to my original question, and then we'll get into the nitty gritty about art making and all that. How do you introduce yourself at parties?
Oh like, my gosh. That's such a good question. I try not to.
Yeah.
I try to avoid it. I usually say that I am a documentary host / musician. And typically in the circles that I would run in the before times when parties were happening, I'm in a group of people where a lot of them are multi-hyphenates. And so a lot of people might understand that you are, you know, a choreographer, but you're also working on this podcast that you're really excited about. And neither one is like center stage. And then one is like something that you don't care about. You care about both of them and you're balancing them at the same time. And they're different expressions of who you are. And they're both so important and integral to how your humanity is processed. So that's how I probably wouldn't say that, but I would say that like, I host and produce documentaries and unscripted content, and I also make music. And a lot of my work in unscripted will sit with me until I can process it through my music. They sort of fuel each other. And then music will open me up to be vulnerable to people in a way that I need to be for unscripted. To sit down and have an interview with someone, I need to be able to be as vulnerable and giving to them as I would hope that they would trust to be with me. And so having both is so important. And there isn't one that is like right now, obviously we're not filming. It's not a great time to tour the country and sit down with strangers during a pandemic. So I'm focusing heavily on my music, but I know that those skills in tapping into myself emotionally and sort of like excavating a lot of the shit that like I have to process from like growing up, things I couldn't talk about at the time, will only help me be a better interviewer, be more available to someone, be more empathetic when that time comes, that I'm able to open up to people again and hopeful that they might do the same with me.
I mean, as you're describing that, I'm like, of course it works that way, right? Of course, one informs the other. You have all of this experience interviewing people and getting to know people's stories. And then of course that works on you. And then of course your music then works on you too. Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating to hear. And I wonder why that is that we feel like if you're around a group of multi-hyphenates, as I am too, it's like we all get it. But there's also this tension, at least that I feel, of trying to prove myself beyond that circle, even when I never even talk to, like, well, right now, I'm like very, you know, we're all very isolated, but there's still that inner tension that I feel that, and I blame everything on capitalism. I'm like, well, it's capitalism.
Just same.
Like,
same. I'm so happy. We're so happy. I know you.
Yes. Yeah. You see me. I see you. So I'm usually just blaming it on capitalism. I was like, well, they want us to like pigeonhole us, to like make us a business. And art is not art. Of course in our society is a business. Of course it is, because everything is in this society that we live in. But art in its fundamental presence is a conversation, like what you're saying, between yeah. this medium and this medium. And I just think it's so cool. I think it's really cool and really inspiring to see someone like you who's so good at both, to like really hold on to both and be able to say, yeah, this is me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you feel that tension at all, or if you're just like,
yeah. I immediately identified with what you were talking about, because there is something like when you're in circles where you sort of know that people will understand or perhaps have a similar path, or in the case of like, my wife is a lawyer. So that's like one of those jobs you can be like, I'm a lawyer, but she is married to me. So she is very familiar with people who have these, you know, different interests and passions that drive them. And so, you know, you're in these circles where people understand it. I really struggle sometimes. And I think people might be surprised that I do experience social anxiety because of the situations that I put myself in through the documentary. But when I'm in circles where I know it's going to be harder to explain, I do experience social anxiety. Like, how do I feel like I have to explain myself. And I always try and sort of make myself like the butt of the joke, or at least in the past, I would always try and make myself feel smaller. So I would always like diminish my music. Like, I would always be like, I make just like super sad songs. Like, that's what I would say. But the truth is that like, I have taught myself every instrument I know how to play. And I have taught myself the rudimentary producing that I'm able to do from home. And that's not a small thing. That's like hours of work. And we have this tendency sometimes in circles that are unfamiliar to us, where we're nervous that we might not be accepted, to sort of give people that out for us. And I'm trying to get better at not doing that and not making myself feel smaller. And we'll see if I succeed. Because again, I'm not going to any parties these days. But I know when you were talking about that, I totally know the environments that I'm in. I kind of refer to them affectionately as like khaki places. So I stick out like a sore thumb. I've got, you know, I'm covered in tattoos. And like, I love, that's the my expression, my how I've come to be visually is like a huge part of my gender expression. It's like how I feel comfortable, and I love it so much. It's the first time like the past 2 years that I've looked at myself in the mirror and been like, hell yeah. Like, I used to hate looking at myself in the mirror, but I also recognize that because of my gender presentation, I will go into certain parties. I have gone into certain parties or events, and I'm weird to them. And I have to remind myself that I'm not weird. Right. Like, in some ways we sort of broke out of the matrix, you know, like none of these rules are why, like, you don't have to dress any type of way. Tattoos indicate nothing but artistic expression on a person's body. Right. Like, none of this stuff means anything.
Right.
And it's weird to me that there are whole, like, that you can go into this room and like everyone's talking about the same thing and they're all doing the same thing, and you sort of just want to shake people.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's where my brain went when you were talking about being in circles outside of a creative space where you feel like you're the alien.
Yeah. And it's such a great point. I love that you call them khaki spaces. I think when I talk about it, I talk about civilians.
Oh, no. I wear khakis. I'm a civilian and I wear khakis. I'm just saying that's the little thing that I've started like calling them. Like, I'll talk to Lizzie and I'll be like, oh, I think it's gonna be kind of a khaki scene, and she'll be like, yeah, I think so.
And what's interesting about that is like, it does evoke something, right? Like, khaki evokes something that we can all grab onto and know. And I do agree with you too, that we're kind of breaking out of the matrix. So as we break out, and as more and more people are like, oh, we're cogs in a machine, and like, think for yourself, and, you know, get a tattoo, it's not a big deal. Like, it's fine, mm-hmm. whatever. And we're also learning how to express ourselves in a more authentic way. I mean, I hate the word authentic with a passion, mm-hmm. but in a truer, more complicated way, which is the real way. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are inner tensions that we hold of like, am I able to break out of this? It is hypnotizing to stay in a space where you can say, and I'm not saying that people in that space, if they say I'm a lawyer, are hypnotized. I'm not saying
right.
That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is for me, I have been hypnotized by those spaces to do exactly what you're talking about. It be like, let me contain myself for you so it's easier and we don't have to go into me. Like we don't have
yeah.
to.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I have a visceral response to it because I attended a conservative school in North Carolina, and which is eventually where I ended up meeting my wife, and I met a wonderful people there. I had a very good experience, but it was kind of during that time that like, I was very ready to come out and I was really trying to, but I was looking around and everyone was so sort of uniform that, and that's no sort of indictment on their end, but just from what I was seeing, it made it really hard for me to see a possibility outside of that expression. It made it really, really hard. And so I remember when I moved to LA, and I would like look around just, you know, driving my car in Burbank, which is like where I moved at the time, or North Hollywood. And, just, you know, seeing people wandering around, totally living their truth. And it was the first time that I was like, oh, that's an option. You know? So I think that I have this response to environments like that because I totally followed the herd, you know, for a time, and it felt gross. And it felt, I try and be kinder to my younger self, but it really, and they did everything that they needed to do for me to be here where I am today, but it felt very cowardly because I knew who I wanted to be. I've always known since I was like six, since I was five or six, I've known who I am. I've always known. You can look at photos of me when I'm really little and like my brother's clothing and just like feeling the fantasy, just like loving my life. And then at some point in time, there were significant messages that came through that I would have to change that in order to fit in. And it's pretty sad to see that come around the ages of like 12 onward is when that you can really see that in photos. And I feel like I really sort of doubled down in college. And that's why when I get in those environments, it's this opportunity now for me to fiercely be myself and almost like stare the thing that I'm afraid of in the eye and be like, no, I don't need to change to be like anyone else except for who I am. And it sounds like kind of like a Sesame Street after school special, but it was pretty significant for me.
You know, it doesn't sound that way. I mean, I have a 2-year-old girl, and I'm already thinking about like, how can we preserve this freedom when she gets to like 11, 12, 13? Because even if my husband and I are like doing all the things that are helpful in creating that, like, she still lives in a world that's going to be like, oh, this is how it is, kid. And that time is so precious. Like that 12, we had different experiences obviously in our lives because we're different people, but like that time is hard. And then you layer it with all these things, like how I don't fit in my classmates or, you know, like religious world, which has a lot of a huge impact on us. Even if we grow up and kind of dissociate from that, it's like those things still linger. And I'm actually really interested in how you came to know your faith as an adult, how growing up in a faith world, because your dad was
he should be retired at this point because he's old, but I don't think he is. So my dad is an Episcopal priest. He's currently a chaplain, which is like a preacher or pastor for the Ohio River region. So he works with like the towboatsmen and all the mariners that come through there. And so I was very much raised like in the church. I mean, I lived in a rectory growing up, so it just basically the church, like
literally,
like the literal
physically
church building. Literally. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of gleaned from your work, and maybe I'm wrong, so please correct me, that you still have a connection to your faith.
Yes, very much. Yeah.
Very much. Okay. So I'm really fascinated how that connection to your faith, if it has changed, if it hasn't changed, how it's impacted your art. I mean, it's a really big question. So like, feel free to tackle it however you want. But I'm really fascinated by that.
So I was raised in the church. So I was raised knowing, I was raised, you know, to believe the Bible stories and just a very traditional upbringing of what you would imagine like a preacher's kid. Like, I'm going to church at least once a week, but usually more than that for different things. If there's a church function, I'm there. And praying before bed every night with my dad and all this stuff. But I'm really fortunate that my parents were always very open. I don't know why they were that way. We've literally tried to troubleshoot this with my parents. Like, I've asked them about how they were so cool being the preacher and the preacher's wife. And I'm not really sure what it was. I mean, I think my parents are a bit older, and so maybe they just had a bit of perspective that they, you know, having my mom had me when she was 40 years old. So like, there was some time for her to really think about what you want for your kid. You kind of realize like what's really important, what's not. Yeah. But I think that's just my parents are really good people. They're really, really good and loving people. So when I became a teenager and I started sort of bristling at church things, and I was very aware that I was gay, but I wasn't out to my parents yet, but there were subliminal messages and things that I would experience at youth group and church functions and mission trips and all that stuff, that they were really receptive if I wanted to stay home. And I was never like forced to go to anything, and I was never forced to pray any type of way. I was never forced to dress any type of way for church. That was really significant because I would only wear basketball clothing to church, which is a choice, but that's
I
what
love, I love
working that. Out for the Lord, just really in basketball shorts. But when I started sort of seeing where Christianity was going directionally, I felt isolated privately, where you'd have conversations with kids on the bus going to and from something, an event, and they would just casually mention that marriage was between a man and a woman. And that's like the sort of thing that you are like, oh, I'm not safe here. This isn't like for me. Am I going to cause a big hubbub about this because my dad is the priest at this church? And my dad actually was always affirming. Mm-hmm. No, I'm just going to kind of shut up, and I'm going to privately not care about faith anymore. So for a while I was just not really interested in anything. And I would like kind of try and pray when I got sad. And I had a depressive episode, my first year of college, and I would kind of try and find faith, but it just was really not happening. Like, it just was not really there. And then as soon as I started being honest with myself about who I am and being more authentic, oh, sorry, I know I don't like that word.
No.
but basically, like, when I started just dressing as myself, I know that sounds perhaps a bit surface level, but it was huge for me that I could just live my life every day, leave my door looking like me, and people would see me as me and receive me as me, whether that be good or bad. It was the first time that I really was interested in picking up my Bible again and going back into what scripture is saying, or what is this faith thing that my dad devoted his whole life to? And then having the example the whole time current to all of this, that my dad is a man of faith and that he devoted his life to this and that he loved me no matter what. And that there were other people that didn't, but that he was constant. And so I think it was once I was able to be myself, then I was able to access God in a personal way that didn't feel like I'd been indoctrinated by something when I was a kid. Although I still struggle with doubt a lot. Like, I still struggle with how I was maybe programmed, and am I just praying because it's like a comfort thing from when I was a kid? I still struggle with all of that. And that's totally represented in my music, especially on the EP that's coming out. So I hope I'm answering your question. It's been complicated. Is that?
Yes. Yes. It's been complicated. You know, it's so funny. I think that what you're saying, I can't like quite, I don't know if I can articulate it how I'm experiencing you say it, but as you're talking about, I couldn't come to it until I knew who I was, or maybe not that you always knew who you were, but until you embraced it in all those ways that we embrace it. I mean, I have a friend who's a stylist and loves fashion, and she has taught me about how fashion is political. Like it is art. It is, I mean, mm-hmm. it's also not like, but even, you know, it's like when they say things that, well, it's not political, everything's political, you know, mm-hmm. same with fashion. Like everything you wear is saying something, is an expression, is an extension of your physical self in some way, right? It's, mm-hmm. it's a flare we're shooting up. And, I just wonder, I wonder about that dynamic between embracing who we are and then being able to meet these really complicated questions. Because like, what is faith? Do I believe in God? I have these doubts, but what does that mean? Does that mean my faith is shaky or, you know, and I don't even really know if I have a question with that, but
Well, I think that we're all spiritual beings having a human experience.
Right.
So until when I was ignoring my humanity, when I was really trying to suppress it and be like, no, like even, so I came out as gay and then I was like, but I was really hell bent on not being too gay, which is like now, but I would like come out to people and I'd be like, but I'm not going to cut my hair. Like, don't worry. I'm not going to cut my hair. And people like my dearest friends would be like, Grace, no one's bringing that up. Like, why are you talking about this? Because I deeply wanted to cut my hair.
You wanted everything so bad. Yeah.
I wanted it so bad. I was so afraid of stepping into my power. Like that's really what it was. I was so, because I knew that how I am now, who I am today, is exactly who I've always wanted to be. And I was so scared to admit that, because I knew that by accepting that, it was going to change my life forever. And you're so afraid of the unknown. Now it's like, oh my, what was I thinking? This is amazing. It's so freeing. I feel the sense of relief and I feel this new sort of spiritual awakening that I never would have had access to before. But I really think that until I was able to acknowledge who I am, like you have to accept who I am and step into that fully. There was who was a God to me? I was my own sort of tormentor. I was my own sort of alpha and omega at the time. It was all about like me and like how I can just keep this all in. And I was afraid of like opening this Pandora's box, but it was a beautiful opening. It was a beautiful thing. And so, yeah, I just think we're all sort of these spiritual cosmos inside each soul. I really believe that, but we're having this human experience. So you have to be honest with who you are as a human. And I think that once you tap into that, there's something that awakens inside of you. At least that's how it was for me.
Yeah, no, that resonates deeply. I can't wait to talk about it in therapy this week. no, it does resonate deeply. And I think, I love the we're spiritual beings having a human experience, not a human being have a spirit mm-hmm. having a spiritual experience, because it does kind of set the groundwork for us to be honest. Like, who cares? We're beyond. Mm-hmm. So all of our own prejudices against ourselves, even like that's just get that out of the way.
It just sort of falls away, because you realize like what all it like we said at the beginning, you realize, oh, why do I need to be in the matrix? Like I don't need to be,
right?
I can be free. And it's scary because you're like, well, what's on the other side? Like, what's on the other side of that freedom? I think that's why we talk so much about like abolition and liberation, because that's really what we're about, like breaking free of these bonds.
Yeah.
And for me, gender was one. And for me, sexuality was one, but it looks different depending on each person. Right. Everyone's going to have their own struggle and burden that they will need to free themselves from if they are brave enough, you know? And I believe that if you do that, then you sort of, it's kind of a familiar way of saying it, but you sort of level up, you know?
Yeah, I do. I feel like you're telling me the things that I personally need to hear. So thanks.
You're welcome. I did my research before this podcast.
You're like, this person just has so many judgments about herself, as we all do. So I guess my question then is, how'd you do that? How'd you embrace yourself, accept yourself? And then also, was that a turning point in your work at all? Did the work come before that kind of self-embrace, or what was the chronology of that?
There are a few sort of turning points or like forks in the road for me that I can identify. The first one is the depressive episode I had my first semester in college. I was asked to leave that college, and I moved back home with my parents. And that was, and I was like mandated to go into therapy for a year, which I'm really, really grateful for. And I have been meaning to like go back into therapy because I'm a big believer that we should openly be talking about mental health. And I love that we're sort of decreasing the stigma around like seeking help when you need it and when you don't, you know, when everything feels fine, like it's tools that you can use. So during that year, was a major turning point for me in that I couldn't be in the closet anymore. I was kind of in the closet to some people, and then I wasn't to others. And I was very much having like secret relationships, and there was a lot of my life was in secret. And I think I can no longer be at this institution, you have to go live with your parents type of, you know, real shit, was a big wake-up call to me of like, you need to figure yourself out. Like you can't really ignore this anymore, and you can't be leading a double life. It's not working for you. Right. So I think that was the first step, and that sort of was the, I guess, led me to start coming out to more people and live more openly, and set certain parameters for myself that I really stood by. And it actually, I was just talking about this with my wife, that I remember, because of tools that I had in therapy before I met her, I had learned how to like kind of set boundaries for myself. And one of them was that I didn't want to date someone who wasn't out. It wasn't going to be healthy for me if I dated someone else that was in the closet. And this was some like a year or two after I'd been out of living at home, but I'd still like kind of set that boundary, and I knew that I could stick to it because I'd been really strengthened and empowered in therapy. And then I think it was like 6 months later, I ended up meeting Lizzie, who was out at the time. And I remember being like, when she kind of casually mentioned it in class, I was like, because we're like in a small school in North Carolina, it's like a conservative school, and I was like, this is insane. Like, this is wild. I must know this girl. And she ignored me for months, but it's fine. It worked out. Yeah. And then the other turning point was when I moved to Los Angeles, and I was hanging out with a friend of mine. I just graduated from the same school in North Carolina, and a friend of mine just asked me point blank. He's very blunt. And he was like, do you like what you wear? And at that time I was dressing like how I had at Elon at school. I was very like skinny girl with like a skinny girl jeans with the flats and like the lace top and whatever. But I was always me. Like my mannerisms were still me. And he was like, are you like digging this that you're wearing? And I was like, I hate it. I literally hate everything I own. I hate how I look. I hate looking at myself in the mirror. I'm deeply unhappy. And he was like, he gave me a bunch of his hand-me-downs, and he just like took me shopping. And I will say that he is not the person you would expect to be this way. He's like not, we disagree on many things, but on this, he just really showed up for me. And I think that was like another turning point of someone who I might've thought would hold a lot of judgment for someone who's, you know, genderqueer like myself, but actually like surprised me in a really beautiful way. And was just like, you don't need to do all this. Like, just be you. Like, people will love you. We love you. You can just be you. So I think those were two turning points that really opened me up to what I do now. And then the third and probably the most sad is the reason why State of Grace got started was because my oldest friend, who was really like a family member to me, I asked her to be my maid of honor, and she said that she couldn't because of religious reasons. That's a long story, very short, but that's really what it played out as. And it's probably the biggest, it's pretty heartbreaking still. It's just someone you thought you'd be in your life forever. Like, we always talked about that day, and it was very blindsiding. And in my conversations about that moment with friends was when my friend was a producer at the time for Refinery 29 and was like, I think we could do a show about this. And I was like, who would watch it? Like, this is silly. Like, well, I don't know, maybe. And she, you know, created a deck and pitched it, and we shot the pilot. And then I think like 3 months later, they ordered 4 more episodes, and we just kind of kept rolling from there until the pandemic hit. And so those are like 3 specific sort of turning points. I like to think that the first 2 are happy, and the final third is still kind of at this like unresolved, sad place, but I'm hopeful. Life is long. I think that we could reconnect. So
yeah,
I don't know.
Well, talking about your show, State of Grace, such a great title. I love
it. Thank you. I didn't think of it. It wasn't me.
I mean, it's so good. You are so wonderful as a host, because I guess, assumption in the world, I'm like, it could be really, well, I don't know what your experience of it is, but I could imagine being in this situation, talking with people who perhaps disagree with, like, people just being themselves. I don't even know how to put it. Like, just people being their human self, and being really frustrated and being really angry. And I'm not saying that you have or haven't felt those things, but I will say that in the series, you have so much grace, but you have so much sincerity behind what you're doing and what you're saying and what you're asking. And I feel like a lot of times in any conversation, but certainly in a documentary series or something where like the camera picks up everything, it's really easy to be able to tell if there's something else lurking behind the question. I'm asking you about this, but I'm really just having a joke.
Yeah.
It's like press conference we ever had with Trump, and the journalists are just like, you fucking idiot. And he's like, you know, whatever. It's like, we know what you're saying, but in State of Grace, like, you really have this ability, I think, as a host and as a, you know, documentarian, to ask the sincere question. And I just wonder, do you think about sincerity? Do you think about that as a value or a concept? Is that true, what I'm picking up? Is that true?
Yeah, no, it's totally true. I'm happy that that has come across, because I think for an unscripted show, or when you're hosting anything, you really have to bring your own personality and your own perspective to the gig, right? To the job. So for a show like State of Grace, that is very much from my perspective, it required me to evaluate, like, what do I tonally want to bring to this interview, and who am I when I meet people and when I learn about them, what impression do I want to make, both on this person that I'm meeting and then also on the person who's going to be watching this, because having clear intentions is make or break, right? Like, you really need to know, like, what you're trying to get out of it. And when I search myself, and people will approach things totally differently, and there are people who have sort of a more aggressive, combative, or some that are more aloof, or some that are more comical. And I think all of that is really valid, and we need lots of expression when it comes to like unscripted interviews. I think we really need like all of it, because it's so important. But for me, I'm just really a curious person. I think I grew up internationally, and that fueled a lot of how I see the world. Growing up in a school where at one point in time, there were 50 different nationalities in my graduating class of 63 people. So that's a lot of different ways to see the world and ways to be.
Right.
And I grew up with that being so normal. And I think that that's something I can bring to the table when I interview someone. And then I also think that being a fish out of water myself in most circles I'm in, there are exceptions like at a gay bar, but most of the time I'm a little bit of an odd one out. And I think that I can bring that vulnerability of just like, I'm just openly being me to the table. And that sets an expectation or perhaps more of an invitation to the person I'm interviewing that like, you're going to be safe with me because I'm not your cookie cutter interviewer. You know, I am not going to try and do like gotcha journalism. I believe you when you tell me about what you've been through, even if I disagree with it. Mm-hmm. I believe that if you're going to be honest with me about how you feel, then I believe you. We can disagree on facts and we probably will.
Right.
But if you can offer me sincerity and honesty in your feelings, then I will meet you there. It doesn't mean that we will not disagree when this goes to edit and we're fact checking things. And I'll be really open and honest about that too. I appreciate when people are the same. You know, there was an interview that we did. It was an early one. And I'm out in the parking lot before we meet the person that I'm supposed to be interviewing. And their publicist people are out in the parking lot with me. And basically the team was getting like B-roll shots because they want the time that I meet the person to be actually the time I meet the person on camera. So I'm just kind of loitering outside with their PR people in the parking lot. And I'm a fun person to be around. So we're just cracking jokes. We're just joking around. Honestly, I'm feeling very comfortable. And the person that I was interviewing is someone I strongly disagree with when it comes to biblical marriage. And so we're in the parking lot, we're talking, and midway through, I just sort of asked the two people that I'm speaking with, I was like, oh, by the way, do you agree with the person in there about what we're going to be talking about? Are you on kind of their side of the conversation? And both of them, because we've just been like laughing, both of them were like, yeah, yeah. So I was like, oh, so you think that my wife and I are living in sin. And they were like, yeah. And they were like, so they felt so bad. Like they felt like so like badly about it. And it was interesting because the whole thing was like off camera, but I remember sort of saying, I really appreciate your honesty. That must have like sucked to say. It doesn't mean, I was like, it definitely hurt my feelings or like, I was like, that's so surprising. Like I wouldn't have thought that because they were sort of younger. They were probably in their early 20s. I understand though, their church, you know, has taught them that. And there's a scriptural understanding for why that is. I just vehemently disagree with it. So I recommended some different teaching things that maybe they, if they were interested in expanding their knowledge, their biblical scholarship, that there are a lot of queer theologians that they might be interested in, but I didn't want them to feel like, I was like, I don't want you to sit in this feeling of like feeling bad about telling me that. I appreciate your honesty, but I wonder, since we've come to this nice little friendship out here in the parking lot, you might think I'm an intelligent person. Perhaps you could look at some of the resources I've discovered. And I think that by allowing that honesty from them, I hope they did look it up. One of them follows me on Instagram to this day. So I don't know, maybe things have changed for them. And I was able to sort of soften their approach by being available to them in that way. But I'm not saying that that's prescriptive. If someone does not want to be available to that type of, to someone just being like, yeah, I super think that you're a sin. I absolutely understand it. I think that it's because I was raised with such incredible parents who were always so loving from a place of faith that I'm able to be available to like backhanded, like low-key bigotry, if you know what I mean, just sort of like, just like low-key homophobia, just casual parking lot homophobia.
Oh, it's fascinating. Two things that you said, that you believe the person when they're speaking, when they're telling you their feelings, even they're based on facts that you completely disagree with, and that you also hold space for the answer to come through. Maybe those are two, you know, textures of the same moment, so to speak. But I think a lot of times when we're asking questions, we're looking for the answer ahead of time, And so there's not that freedom to give and take. Like, there's not that freedom for someone to say, there's often not that freedom for someone to like tell you what their real answer is. Like, I don't believe in your way of life. That mm-hmm. is a hard thing to say. It's also completely generous, I think, of you to be like, okay, it's okay. I'm going to redirect you right here a little bit, but in a loving and generous way. And like, it's okay. It's okay. And then also just the, I think we have such a problem right now believing each other in what we're saying. It feels like, are you gaslighting me? Are you, you know, whatabouting me? Are you redirecting me so that like we don't have to actually have that conversation? But I think that's what's so interesting about the series, and that's what's so interesting about your music too. It really does feel like we linger in these tensions. We linger in mm-hmm. these contradictions, which kind of goes yeah. back to your whole like, yeah, we're having a human experience. The human experience is contradicting, confusing,
yeah,
manipulative, yeah. I think, beautiful.
Yeah, I think getting comfortable in that is how we can provoke real change.
Right.
Because I think when you sort of, when you only deal in like absolutes, especially with people that you disagree with, it, in my experience, sometimes it can just be harder to invite them to consider something differently. Unfortunately, I find myself often in the position of like being the one who's uncomfortable in order to like bring them closer towards progress and towards how I see a more just world. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, that is my approach, but I know that, you know, reasonable minds can differ. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, it's cool to have conversations with people you disagree with, but I think some of my, just to show that you can do that, I think you can have really interesting moments. But I also like the moments on the show when we interview people who just have an incredible story and have done incredible work. And I think of like Diane Latiker in our episode about gun violence and sort of faith in guns and the conversation of like thoughts and prayers after gun violence. Her work is incredible and what she's been doing in Chicago. And all I wanted to do in that interview is just let people meet Diane. At the end of our interview, I remember she said, she was like, it feels like we didn't even do an interview because I just wanted to have like tea with this person and let's get it on camera. Let's get this lighting looking amazing because she deserves it. And then let's just let her tell her story. I don't need to do anything on this. This is not, there's no sort of confrontational moment that I'm looking for. I don't want the audience to feel any discomfort. I actually want them to be inspired and comfortable with how an ordinary person can affect so much change in a community that needs it just by opening up their heart and literally opening up their door. And I think about her, and then I think about our death penalty episode, where most of those interviews, except for maybe the interview at Planned Parenthood, I'm just a conduit. I'm mostly just sitting there, and I know what the person, what story we're trying to get from this person that will create a good episode, I hope. But there were a few interviews that we did in our episode on the death penalty and abortion that I probably didn't speak for 5 or 10 minutes because someone, you know, they just really wanted to unload and tell the world what they'd been holding on to. And now you have an opportunity. Like, we have a YouTube channel with like millions of, you know, subscribers. Like, you have this opportunity. You have the mic now. And this is a beautiful thing that we can offer you with social media. People will hear you. You're a voice that has been ignored for far too long. So like, what do you want to say? Just say it to me and we'll make sure it gets out there. So I think finding the balance between those interviews where it's like, ooh, this is a confrontation and we want to show people that you can sit in discomfort and you can have these moments with people you disagree with. And that's important. But then there also are moments where it's like, I want to highlight important social justice work. And that's not, I don't have shit to do with that. Let's highlight the people who are doing it. Right. So I think that's like finding that balance in the show. And sometimes like the best interviews are the ones that I said the least.
Yeah. Well, it's also an interesting, I mean, it's an interesting kind of framework too, because you're talking about, okay, you as an artist, as a documentary filmmaker, sometimes it is about the question. Sometimes it is about the silence from your end or the creating of space. So someone mm-hmm. feels a certain way, and those are different tools, and those are different. Like, I think a lot of times in our American culture, we think like output, that means I'm productive. That means yeah. I'm artistic and creative and all of that. But there, and especially in the past year in 2020, I've been thinking a lot about stillness and obviously isolation and stagnation and all these things that stop us. And what is that space, you know? And I think that not that you were creating a stagnant moment at all, but mm-hmm. you're creating a stillness in you to allow something else to come through in that moment. And I think it's a brilliant technical part of the artistic craft. Know when to pick up the words, know when to put them down, know when to create space, and all of those things kind of hold equal weight, even though mm-hmm. Americans like to be like more.
Yeah.
Along those lines, I know everything shut down because of the pandemic, but I'm fascinated by how much work you put out. I don't know if you feel like that. I'm like, this music, so much music, this amazing docuseries. Also, I'm not really a Twitter person, but I did look you up on Twitter because
No.
Well, all of my stuff is like retweeting about Bernie Sanders. So I'm like really not a Twitter person. Like, oh, that sounds good. But you, I feel, are very engaged there in a way that is also connected to pop culture. Like, it feels like you are engaged, yeah. you know?
And yeah, I also started a TikTok during quarantine.
Oh my gosh. Well, okay.
It's my favorite. I love TikTok. I'm obsessed.
Okay, so look, I didn't download TikTok as kind of like a protest not download.
Yeah.
Now I don't think I can do it, right? Because isn't it banned or something?
No, I think it's still up. I don't know.
Well,
it should be still. I don't know.
All right. So I obviously should figure this out, but because TikTok is the way. I get it.
It's very fun. It'll suck you in. I mean, I apologize in advance. You'll like hit me up in a few weeks being like, Grace, I haven't been off my phone since I downloaded TikTok.
I forget what my child looks like.
yeah.
But I guess my question lurking in there is how do you put out so much content? And what are your plans, I guess, post-pandemic? Is kind of funny because I feel like we'll live here for a little while.
For the rest of our lives, yeah.
Yeah, like we're going to be making art about this time for like until 2060. but I guess my question is twofold. How do you put so much out? And also, what are you going to do next? Or where are your sights set? Maybe you don't know exactly what.
Well, I think, honestly, I work a lot. I've been very busy recently. And I think that the way that I'm able to maintain the sort of output that I have been doing is because I'm very inspired by my work, and it feels urgent and timely. And I just feel so connected to what I'm doing, the stories that I'm trying to tell, and the people that have been resonating with my work. It's kind of the first time recently in maybe my whole life that I really feel as though I'm finding people and I'm telling stories in a way that just feels so right. Like, I can't ignore it. And so that kind of fuels me, but I won't lie to you, my hours are strange. I also, as far as music goes, I have like jingle, like it's always going in my head. It's hard to explain, but like I can't go for a the EP opens and you'll hear the sounds of me walking my dog. And that's intentional because I can't walk my dog, which I do 3 times a day, without something happen, like a, something in my head, like a melody will come and the lyrics come at the same time. And it's really strange. And when I started dating my wife, I remember she told me one time, she was like, I think that you think that this thing is normal because I thought everyone had like little soundtracks. Like if I'm driving in my car, I've just had an interaction with someone, I'm writing a song about it in my head. And she was like, it's not to say they're good songs. I'm not saying they're all good. Like a lot of them don't get written down, but that's just kind of how my brain works. And I think especially recently, I did this thing on TikTok called like the Queer Christian Cover Band. And it had like almost, I think like 2 million views or something. And I was covering Christian songs, but I was a queer artist doing them. And so it sort of allowed people that had been outcast from their faith to participate in this trend. And see, I didn't think anyone would care. I did the first one kind of as a joke about Reliant K. I called it Reliant Gay. And then so many people started duetting it on TikTok. And honestly, you know, it really took off in like this very unexpected way that I started writing all this music about this perspective. And that's how Preacher's Kid got started. But concurrent to doing that, I'm also developing different, like 3 different unscripted ideas that are pretty, I mean, none of them have been green lights. So I'm not going to say anything. I don't like when people are like, it's so secret, I can't tell you yet. But it's just like, it hasn't been, nothing's been bought yet, but they're in development hell or whatever. And so I'm concurrent to doing that, like developing those decks and all that stuff. I'm like writing all this music. So it's just been like strange working hours. And the only way that I can explain why is because I'm just so inspired. And hopefully what comes next is a tour when I'm available to do that, when that's safe. I would love to. I would love to just create like a show for and by people who have been outcast from their faith. Yeah. So that they can feel safe and celebrated, and that you can hear that you're loved from a stage, because I know what it feels like to hear that you're not from a stage. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would be really wonderful if we could all gather, because we've all sort of found each other on the internet. And so if we could do even like a 5-city tour and those formative bands that contributed to some of our religious trauma, many of whom have left that tradition, if we could bring them back on stage and so they could say, I love you, it's okay. You know, I think that could be amazing. And then hopefully, you know, one of these projects will get greenlit, and then I'll be back in like the unscripted documentary space. And so that's what my hope is for. I hope that as soon as I'm safe to do so, I'm traveling a lot. I would like to be, I really feel my best when I'm traveling. So long as I have an instrument that I can play, because of, again, the noise in between my ears, because if I don't and I'm on the road, because when we filmed State of Grace, I obviously didn't bring a guitar with me, and I would have to sleep with the TV on, and my producer slept in the same room as me. And she was like, you need to, like, I don't sleep. She was like, you don't sleep until like I have the TV on loud so I can stop the noise.
To just like quiet your own.
Yeah. Brain.
Oh my gosh.
It's so weird. Yeah. I sleep great. I sleep great with my wife, which I know is kind of corny, but when she's out of town, I don't sleep. And I really, it's something I'm not good at, sleeping.
Well,
except for naps. I'm really good at naps. I'm really good at naps.
Listen, don't sleep on naps, pun intended. naps are great.
I haven't been
able to nap in 2 years. That's so great. Come to New York when you do that.
Yes.
Come to New York. So I don't want to take up too much of your time, but there's one question that I really want to ask. And I thought of it today. And it was because I was thinking about your songs. Wait, I wrote it down. When I Go and Panic Attack at a Party.
Oh, yeah.
So beautiful. Both of them. And the way that they ended, like, it's kind of what we were talking about earlier. It's like this kind of lingering, like there's not a resolution.
Yeah.
Like it's like Panic Attack at a Party. I like, that was one of the ones where I was like, I feel seen. and like, I feel that, like, it was just so, and also like, just want to say your music also has this very, I want this to come out the right way, parental quality. And I don't mean parental, like, old. I mean, mm-hmm. in a tender, compassionate way, we're going to look at this really hard thing. Mm-hmm. And there's all this, like, even in like the kind of like grittier sounds or grittier lyrics, there's still this tenderness that's in it. And as I was listening to those songs and they kind of lingered and faded and we didn't really resolve, I thought about this New York Times article that I'd read maybe, what is it, 2021, probably like 6 or 7 years ago, about how human beings don't, and artists, don't know how to write endings because we've never had one. Because after death, like, right? Kind of like, psh, it blew my mind as a writer and filmmaker and all that. Like, okay, right, we haven't had an ending. So it's always mm-hmm. the struggle for the art, not always the struggle for, it's been a struggle for me. It's always like what we're, when we go to a movie, we're like, ah, I wouldn't have ended it like that. Like, we all have an opinion about the ending, you know?
So yeah.
And I feel like, I just felt like in those couple of songs, it made me think about how right the ending was there. And I don't know if it's a conscious thing, but I would love to know how you think about endings in your work. Maybe it's music, maybe you're thinking about mm-hmm. a series, but how do you think about ending?
That's such an, wow, you did just blow my mind with that New York Times article. That makes so much sense. Endings are so difficult. I never know how to end a song, but there are a few, and it's interesting, the two that you mentioned that I really didn't know how to end a song. But I remember with When I Go, the ending of that song is just Zach, who I make music with, and there's like the sound of a slamming door that we picked up by accident because a mic was going, and then like gasps of air. And because I thought that might be like a cool punctuation, but then we didn't use it as just one punctuation. We're like, oh, what if we just stack them and we throw them all over? And it kind of became this blowout. Mm-hmm. And the song, I just did it in one take. It's on the piano. It's really bare bones instrumentals. But then the end of that song is there tracks on tracks on tracks on tracks on tracks. Right. It's like super stacked. And I think that it's interesting because it was so deliberate that we didn't know how to finish the song. So we ended up stacking a whole bunch of stuff. Because how do you end a song about dying?
Right.
I don't know. We both said that it sounded, you know, we wanted this sort of rise at the end to sort of feel like if you close your eyes, maybe, you know, what it would feel like to leave this life, you know, and trying to recreate that, but we don't know what that is. And so we just ended up throwing so many things against the wall, and it ended up creating this really nice swell. I think it's a pretty dramatic, cool ending to especially the EP that it was on at the time. But it was sort of this haphazard attempt at trying to find an ending. And I think for Panic Attack at a Party too, which is alarmingly autobiographical, like I literally was, I've had actually a few panic attacks at parties, but this one was actually about a year ago. And I just remember like leaving, be like, I need to get an Uber. And you know that feeling where you are in a room and you can't say it because you don't want to freak anyone out, but you want to scream, I can't be here. Oh my gosh, I can't be here. Mm-hmm. And at the time that I wrote it and at the time that I recorded it, because panic attacks can linger. Panic, that feeling that can really sit with you for a while, takes some time to come down. So at the time that I wrote it and recorded it, which was I think about within 3 days of it happening, and me writing it in the Uber and then recording it a day or so, something like that later, there was no resolution because I was still feeling it. So I think I don't even think I tried to look for it. I don't even remember how that song ends. I think I just got to the point. I knew that the one thing I knew that I didn't want to do is that I probably could have had the line, I hate it, go on for minutes.
Yeah.
And so I probably could have had that for minutes and minutes and minutes. And I remember trying to limit myself from being a bit too manic in my approach and being like, this is a 2-minute song. You expressed it. You're in, you're out. Yeah. Let's leave it and put it up on SoundCloud. And the response was enough that I ended up putting it up on Spotify too. But at the time, sometimes I just put songs up on my SoundCloud. It's sort of like a blog of what's going on with me and where you can hear all my shitty jingles and stuff. There's some that I put up that are secretive, where I'll go on Instagram and I'll be like, if you want a link, I'll send it to you the next 24 hours only, because they're so personal and like I'm naming names and I know that it would be a bit reckless to put that publicly, because it is just, you know, I have to use this instrument in my brain for good. And sometimes I'll write a song and I'm like, if I were to put this out, it would be for evil, even though I know I feel it at the time. You don't need to be name dropping and putting out diss tracks every time someone slights you.
Right.
So if you ever hear a song about Courtney, you'll know. I'm just kidding. I'm very fond of you. I would never do that.
No, but it's true. There's a discernment that we have to have as artists to know, you know, maybe you don't know that it's the end of something, but you know that it's enough. You know, yes. Maybe you don't know if that's the right ending, but you know, that's what you have, you know, and there's the discernment as an artist being like, you know, the only thing that I can kind of connect to, because I don't write music, I'm fascinated by people who write music, because I'm like, how do you do it? It is fascinating to me and otherworldly. I'm like, you're blessed, like you're touched by God. But the only thing I can liken it to is like when I came to writing by acting, and when I've been on stage or been in scenes with people and I forget everything and I come off stage and I'm like, I don't know what just happened.
Crazy.
But I feel like, well, not like I black out, not like that, but like I don't have that other judgment right there of like, that was a great take, Court, or, you know, or it wasn't, or I just remember moving. We moved through it and it ended, and I'm left with this feeling of like, that was right or that was enough, but I have no idea what it was, you know? And
that's so cool. See, that's cool to me. That's wild. There's no way, I don't think I could ever act and not be acutely aware that I was acting.
Well, listen, I'm not saying I was a very good actor when I was doing it, and I was acutely aware of myself many times, most of the time. But those like, you know, amazing moments where you're like, I'm just in it. And I do think that there's a flow when you're creating something. Sometimes I feel like this when I'm writing words, not song, that there is a sort of like, well, this naturally comes next. Don't know why, don't know where from, but that's what naturally comes next. And, you know, and of course, like what you're talking about with the end of When I Go, lots of trial and error too. It's not like you're taking out of that, but there is, I don't know, this something confusing and strange, and we're never going to figure out the endings of things.
Yeah.
Until it's too late.
Yeah. No, I like the idea of like, you're never really done. You're just moving on to what's next.
Yeah.
You know, you never, I've never listened to a song of mine and been like, crushed it. Sometimes. I mean, there have been moments where like a song of mine will come on or something on shuffle and I'll be like, this is pretty good. But yeah. I'll never feel like it's finished. It's just right. That I moved on to something else.
Right.
It was time to move on and leave.
Right. And that is something I was listening to Aaron Sorkin's masterclass earlier today. And
ooh.
He says the same thing about like, there's not an episode of the newsroom that I look at and I wish I couldn't go back and do better. And I think a lot of times people attribute that with artists to like, well, you're a perfectionist and you're always trying to get better. Yeah, it's not that. It's not that. It's not perfectionism. It's, I don't know. What do you think it is?
I think it's that once you open yourself to that expression, once you make yourself available to that, you're kind of always available to it. It's like, if it calls you again, you would be ready to dive back in and explore that medium. You would be able to explore those characters again. You would be able to explore that sort of that melody again and see if you could think of another top line, or maybe you could add a different vocal take. Ooh, that could be kind of interesting. Or, you know, there's always just something to explore. If you really create a whole world, whether that's in like a song that you're creating a world, whether that's in a piece of writing or filmmaking that you're creating a world, that exists. You can visit it again. And there's always going to be something new to discover.
Yeah.
There are exceptions, of course. I'm sure there are certain things where you're like, this is done. But if it's really like an artistic expression that's like visceral and comes from deep within you and really is something from your heart, I think you always can dive back in and explore and uncover new things, and you will have grown as an artist. And so you can come back with new skills, with a new perspective, a different way of looking at harmonies, an instrument I didn't know how to play before that would be super cool on this song. I really want to learn the banjo. And then I'm going to go back through my whole discography and just throw in some banjo.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm first in line for that. No, that's brilliant. Yeah. Once you're available to something, you're available to it. There's really no take backsies. It's like, cause you're opening your heart to it. You're opening your subconscious. You're opening
yourself
in a true way. And once you're open, once you're open and you've been in flow with it and you've engaged in it and you've exercised that muscle, it's hard to just shut it down and be like, no, I'm done. It's really hard to do that.
Yeah. It's almost like being in love in a weird way. Oh, kind
totally.
Of.
Totally. Totally. I mean, it's I stopped myself because I was like, oh my God, Courtney, you're going to sound like your 18-year-old naive little self. But I was about to say, it's like pure love. It's pure. There's a purity in engaging with the things in your soul. That's beautiful. Not that I'm saying that everything that I do is engagement with my soul. Much of it is, as you said, noise, but that's awesome. Grace, I could talk to you for hours.
I know, this has been really nice. I honestly feel like I like learned a lot about myself from talking to you. So thank you.
Oh my gosh.
Because these are really insightful questions and I've been considering my work in a way that I hadn't before. And I really appreciate your like detailed analysis of things I've worked on. It's very humbling and kind. So I really thank you for that.
Well, I'm practicing saying you're welcome. So you're welcome. And also thank you for all of your art, because it, like I said at the beginning, like made a fangirl out of me. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. It's so inspiring from one artist to another to see you embrace all that is, and makes me want to do the same. And I'm really excited for all that's to come for you. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Break Breakdown. I just wanted to pop in and say one more thing about Grace's music. After this podcast was recorded, the Preacher's Kid EP was released, and they topped the iTunes Christian charts as number one. So a completely independent, non-label piece of music about the LGBTQ Christian experience topped Apple Music. And I just think it's amazing. So if you haven't listened to their EP yet, go download and listen to Preacher's Kid. And stay tuned here. We have amazing interviews coming up all season long. Don't miss a thing. And if you liked this episode, take a screenshot of it and tag us on Instagram at Queensbird Films. And show us a little bit of love, and that'll do a lot for helping us get out there. Thanks so much for listening.